accession number 18463, reel 27.
Reel 27.
And we're in this rest area now, in a nice little house there. And John Swarbrick, the platoon commander, he put a bivvy up on the back of the little ridge there. He wouldn't come in with us. We tried to persuade him, but he said, "No, I'm staying away from you, Ruffler." And we had quite a good time there. And a chap named Robert Barnes, first class soldier, he'd come from the Queen's and been with us since October. And he and I always had to have a little wrestle when we were at rest. It was his way of getting his own back on the NCOs, and I never minded, you know. I'd wrestle with any of them if they wanted to get their own back. And we were having a bit of a wrestle on, rolling about on the floor there, and somebody had got a football, and goodness knows where they got a football from. And he kicked this football as hard as he could, and it hit me on the side of the head and nearly knocked me out. And we gave up then, because that was... you know, it was a bit naughty, that, really. But it's the sort of thing that goes on. And we stopped our little wrestling match. And he said, "Have you ever seen the arms drill we used to do in Germany?" So we hadn't. And it's typical what the Americans do, where they swing their rifles about and do all sorts of strange antics with them. And he was demonstrating this to us. One thing was where... you open the bolt, close the bolt, and fire. And of course, he's forgotten he's got a loaded rifle. He fires around into the air. And we know there's going to be trouble now. Everybody scoots for trouble into houses. And we saw poor John Swarbrick shot at the back of his tent, did the flap up, and went silent, because he knew if the company commander came over, he wasn't going to be very pleased with him to be around there. But nobody did. I don't know. Perhaps they... they didn't worry about it. Anyway, nobody came over and reprimanded us. And John said, "I'm off. I'm not staying with you lot anymore." And I presume he went over to where Company HQ was and stayed there for the rest of the trip. But the following day, to my very great surprise, because I wasn't expecting it, I was told I was going on leave. And I went down to Company HQ, and they told me I was off to Japan on leave, which was... great boon. I was very pleased about that. Hadn't expected it, because having been sick a couple of times, I thought that was probably my rest, and there were more deserving cases to go. Bill Everett had been, come back, full of all the tales of excitement and all the wonderful things he'd done there, and some were a bit daughty, and we believed him. And it wasn't until later he told me he was fibbing. I'm sure a lot of people went thinking that if Bill could do these things, so could I. But he hadn't engaged in any of the activities he told us about. Anyway, I'm now off on leave to Japan. Now, whilst we were sitting in the truck waiting to go, people started to come up and ask for various things, and a corporal from Fire Platoon came up, who I know rather well, and said, "Could I collect some parachute wings," which he'd had made in the PX in Tokyo. I took his, he paid for them. Another one came up, wanted some photographs taken from somewhere else, and I said I'd try if I could find it, but he didn't know how to get there, and obviously neither did I. Another chap, one of the cooks, came up and said, "Oh, can you buy me a camera?" And I said, "You're joking, aren't you?" Because, you know, they were quite expensive. Would have taken probably, I guess, about, I can't remember the price. They were very reasonably priced, but far more than I could have got out of my money. So I put that on the back burner, probably said yes. And off we went. And we didn't go very far. We went down to Bierschlon, where we queued up in a little tent. And the QM and his staff, of course, gave us blueberries and a badge. And he wasn't so worried about the blueberries, but he was quite adamant if you came out back without the badge, you'd hang drawn and quartered, because he hadn't got many of those. Pity was, of course, they didn't have the embellishment on, you know, the maroon and old gold embellishment, which we were all rather proud of. Anyway, that was all we had. That was the only equipment. We didn't hand anything in. We got all our arms, ammunition, grenades, the whole lot. Went off there, back onto the truck, and went to Suwon Airfield, which had just recently been recaptured in, I guess, about February, I would think, and was back in operation again. And the Americans are wonderful. When it comes to transporting people, they're absolutely wonderful. There's no problems whatsoever, no documentation or anything. I mean, there must have been some form of documentation, I presume. But we were just led out onto the airfield, and we sat on the side of the airfield, and just there for quite a while, in actual fact, maybe 1 or 2 hours, I should think. And we just sat there and waited for an aeroplane to come along, just like a bus, and pick us up. And during the course of this, just over the other side of the airfield, the most peculiar thing, there were two American MPs, or they may not have been MPs, but they were certainly police of some description. And they had two soldiers digging a hole. Couldn't see how big it was, but they, whilst we were there, they were about 4 foot down when we arrived, and they were down to about head height just before we went. And this seems to be one of the things that the Americans do, which we would never dream of doing. They make their prisoners who've been a bit naughty dig a hole and fill it back in again. And that, I guess it's their policy, their way of doing things, but it did seem a bit strange to us. Anyway, just shortly after this, about an hour, I suppose, a starfighter came in, landed quite close to us, in actual fact. And Elk got a pilot, well-dressed, not in flying suit or anything, and put his hat on, reached into the back of the aeroplane, and brought out on coat hangers two or three jackets who'd obviously been to the cleaners and what have you. So we guessed that he just nipped over to Japan to get his best uniforms for the evening party or something like that. But it did sort of seem the way the other half lived was a little bit different to the way we lived. Shortly after this, 29 Brigade group came, and they were very smartly dressed in battle dress and polished boots and gaiters and all the rest of it, blueberries, with the Gloucesters badge up, the group that came to us were Gloucesters, and they were very smart. They had no equipment other than their pack, small pack, and they no arms either. They'd handed it all in, so they had facilities, presumably, where they could do this, whilst 27 Brigade had nothing like that whatsoever. So we're looking like tramps, and they're looking rather smart. The aeroplane then came along and taxied past us and sort of drew in. And I don't know whether he did it deliberately, but he suddenly revved up his engines, and all the blueberries that have just been found, plus, you know, we've been told not to lose at all costs, go whistling off down the runway. So people are scattering all over the runway, chasing after their berries. I managed to grab mine before it went, and my friend who was sitting next to me, we stopped his, but most of them were off down the runway. Get the blueberries on. And we thought, well, perhaps we're going on this one. And a crew chief got the a ladder out and just called us over. And we just climbed up in the plane. There was no check who or what or where we were. Climbed up. And it was a great a four-engine job. I probably knew the name of it at the time, but I can't remember now. And it was wide-bodied, as wide as... It wasn't as wide-bodied as what we call wide-body today, but it was quite a wide-body. With seats down the sides, nothing in the middle. The middle was for loading stuff, you know, in equipment and stuff like that. And we just sat in these sort of bucket seats around the edge, very small windows behind us at various, like, porthole windows, not very many of them at all. And literally looking up towards the pilot's cabin, there was a metal wall, literally, with a door in it, just as if you're in a house. And the captain, the crew chief, sort of counted us up and filled all the seats up and said no more. It was as simple as that, no check-in. The captain then came up the stairs and had a quick look round, went into the crew compartment, and we were off. It was as simple as that, just like getting on a bus. And we just sat around there, and I'll be honest, most of us went to sleep, I think. I certainly went to sleep in the seat there. And we then presumably flew over the Sea of Japan. And the next thing I remember was it was dark, and somebody called out, "Tokyo!" And we all looked out, and there were the lights of Tokyo down below us. It was a wonderful sight, wonderful sight. Landed, got off the plane, and there were coaches waiting for us, and took us to Ebisu Leave Camp. That was a Commonwealth leave camp, mainly run by Australians and, as we would soon learn, 29 Brigade. Got in there, we we were taken up into an armoury upstairs where we unloaded our weapons and left our grenades and all the rest of it there. Back downstairs again, and we were taken into a large hall where we all sat down in chairs, a bit like a lecture hall, I guess. And a young lieutenant came in, very smartly dressed, and sat down and started to give us a lecture about the camp and what was what about it. And a very rude young man he was, very rude indeed. And threatened us that his police were Marines from the Chuzin Reservoir way who'd been fighting terrible battles, and if we got out of hand, they'd soon sort us out. And of course that was just about the worst thing he could possibly have said, because the Argyles, I mean, you could never tell what the Argyles are saying, but they're sort of grunting away behind us, and the Aussies are suggesting, well, we'll have a little think about this and sort your fellas out for you. But I think nobody wanted to lose their leave, so we all went off. But he was an atrocious young man who should never have been doing a job like this. Went off then for to the bathhouse. And there were what we called them, the fancy corporals, actually. But there were a bevy of corporals from 29 Brigade, all very, very smartly dressed, blanco, brasses. May it put us to shame, their stripes and many medal ribbons. They were Second World War lads. And you had the feeling that maybe they were leaping about there for two reasons. One, they wanted to get rid of us to get out on the town that evening. And the second was that they wanted to keep their jobs back in Japan, which must have been a fairly lucrative job. We'd been warned, actually, before we went, not to let our outer clothing leave us, to hang on to it. Whatever they said, hang on to your outer clothing, because when you get to the other end, it'll be gone. It won't be there, they won't reissue new. So the earlier drafts that had gone off on leave had come back without their winter clothing, and there was none to reissue. So we rolled our field jackets and trousers and inner clothing, inner jacket up, and they were telling us to drop it and put it down, because we'd stripped off everything else and just chucked it in a heap. I mean, it was filthy by this time. It hadn't been washed since we put it on. And we went through to the shower. They were not pleased to let us into the shower with their rolls of clothing, but we were just as adamant and probably fairly rude that we were going to take it with us. Put it aside, had a lovely hot shower, beautiful. First shower since cold showers in Hong Kong. In fact, because I was probably the only one who had a bath, as I previously said, on the 5th of November. Though some people had a shower, we'd have been a mobile bathhouse at Christmas, and we'd marched about 10 miles to it and about 10 miles back, so it didn't do a lot of good, actually, at the double, I might add. So we had a lovely shower, went off down, and there was a reception area. There were young Japanese girls all standing around there, and they were they looked after the bedrooms, made the beds and all that sort of business, and they grabbed our kit, and we were trying to hang on to it because it was so heavy, our stuff, you know, bed rolls and stuff like that. And in the end, she insisted, the one that was helping me insisted that she took something, so I gave her my muskrat, what I call muskrat, the belt and the pouches and all the rest of it, and of course she hadn't got a clue how to hold on to it, tipped it upside down, and rounds started to drop out of the pouches all over the floor, so I followed her up behind trying to pick these rounds up on the stairs, and she's wondering where the devil they're coming from. Upstairs is a dormitory, and all beds laid out, marvellous sheets, it's wonderful. Beds are made down and not made up, so you it's all there ready for you, and a little chest of drawers beside each bed and a chair, absolutely splendid. And it's centrally heated, I might add as well, the barrack room. And she said they could all speak reasonably good English, the girls. And she said, there's your bed. Off, you can go off to a meal to the restaurant. And in the morning, I'll wake you up at 7 o'clock with a cup of tea in bed. I couldn't believe it. Cup of tea in bed at 7 o'clock. Anyway, dropped that kit off. And incidentally, before we actually went up to the bedrooms, we'd been issued, when we came out the showers, we'd been issued with battle dress, all crumpled up not pressed up in any way, no badges of rank or anything like that on, and no chevrons whatsoever, just come straight out the stores, shirts and tie and all the rest of it. So we got all new kit, which we actually climbed into when we came out of the showers. So we sorted ourselves out there, and I piled up down with a chap who was in the next bed. He was from D Company, I remember his name very well, nice, very nice chap. And we went down for a meal, and it was a wonderful meal. Table service with waitresses and napkins and tablecloths and just doing anything you wanted. I can't remember what the meal was, but knowing us, we had a choice, and we usually it was steak and chips or something like that. Probably was this day, in actual fact. And on our table was a Gloucester, a fairly flamboyant chap he was, and fairly. We were a little bit reticent, I think, probably, and he was one notch up on us. he was into everything, and we piled up together, and had our meal. It was too late to go anywhere or do anything, so we went to bed and had slept the sleep of the just. Woken up at 7 o'clock the next morning with our cup of tea in bed, and it was a communal wash place. Wash, shave, cleaned up and things, and we went down, the two of us went down to breakfast, and there was our friend down there, so we met up with him and had a jolly good breakfast, English breakfast, first class breakfast, and then decided to go out together, the three of us. Had a bit of a clean up and polished up the badge and things like that. We didn't have any cleaning kit and things. I can't remember. I think we must have had new boots, because I mean ours were white and terrible. So I guess we had new ammo boots, but I can't be sure about that. Anyway, we went off around the town, went out the main gate. Each side of the main gate there were stalls, Japanese, just like a market, down each side of the gate. And I presume they did quite well from the people in the barracks there. And I happened to say to the Gloucester chap, just what I want. There's a autograph book there. I want an autograph book, and I can take back and get all the lads to sort of sign it for me. And walked on, you know, really thinking much about it. He dropped behind, came up, said, there you are. So, how much did that cost you? Didn't cost me anything. I just picked it up. I said, what do you mean you just picked it up? He said, I just took it. He said, you do that here. He said, the Americans have told us all about it. He said, you don't bother to buy anything. You just go and pick it up. I said, I couldn't believe it. He said, there you are. He said, take an apple off that stall and see what happens. So I just walked on, took an apple. The chap didn't take any notice of me at all. Went off eating it. I couldn't believe it. So he said, well, we'll go by the on the trams or buses or train or anything. We'll go into Tokyo. And he said, you don't pay at any of these places. All you do, he said, as soon as they ask for a ticket or something like that, you say, MacArthur will pay. And MacArthur's such a figure that they don't bother anymore. I couldn't believe it. Poor old MacArthur must have got a bill that would have broken his arm off, I should think. Anyway, we got on a tram, first of all, to go to it was like an underground. I don't think the trains were underground, but they were like underground trains. And got on the tram. And a chap came round for the tickets, and we all said, MacArthur will pay. And he put his head down and walked on, MacArthur will pay, and that was it. We didn't pay. Got to the station, we didn't bother to go to the ticket office, and went up this slope. There's a gate, a couple of chaps, Japanese chaps, uniformed on the gate. MacArthur's paying. All right, through we went, sat on the train, we're off to Tokyo. The trains in Japan, funny enough, quite very smart trains, very smart. But as they fill up when they're near in Tokyo, there are chaps who sort of push everybody in. I mean, we had seats, but they push everybody in and make sure the doors were closed and all that sort of business. Went into Tokyo, and our first stop was the American PX. This was enormous. I should think it must have been as well equipped as Harrods or any very large store in England. I guess it was about 8 floors high. Everything you could conceivably think of. Aladdin's Cave it was, all served by young Japanese, a very smart young Japanese girls, well dressed and what have you. So I found the place where where they were doing the embroidered badges and things like that. I didn't want any. Before we came out, incidentally, we could have gone to the tailors and I could have had my stripes put up, and I don't know whether they'd done Middlesex, but they'd have done things like that. But I didn't bother. I just had a straightforward khaki uniform, blueberry and slacks. I mean, no indication other than the badge who or what we were. So I got these parrot wings, which had been paid for, And we went off down. I don't know why I was, but I felt sort of very uncomfortable in this building because we'd spent, I suppose we'd spent so much time outside, being inside a building with heating and what have you. I wanted to get out. Anyway, we got out and went off down the road for a into a little local cafe and ordered, I can't remember what we ordered, probably tea and something or other to eat. And there was a young Japanese man with his young lady sitting over in the corner. And he came over to us and said, English? I said, yes, English, yes. Korea. Korea? Oh, my goodness, he said, you're out there saving us. And I couldn't believe it. We were the saviours of Japan, apparently, so they seemed to think. So we got chatting to him, and he called the owner of the shop, who was a lady, came out, a Japanese lady, and he said to her in Japanese, and we heard, you know, Korea. And she said, oh, and got the bottle of sake out and started, gave us all the tiny little glasses. And we all had a drink of sake and, you know, toasted and things like that. And when we had another one, and we had another one, and she kept filling our glasses up. And I must say, we were not, we weren't used to drink, because we hadn't had, we'd been young anyway, we didn't drink all that much. And not spirits anyway. A lot of people drank beer in vast quantities, but this was a little bit different, and we were getting a little bit cheerful. And we got talking to this chap, and we said, are there any ex-Japanese soldiers around? Because, you know, we'd like to have a little chat to them if they could speak English. And he said something to the mama-san behind the bar who'd been plying us his sake, and she said, beckoned us over towards her, you see. So I went over to her, and she went pointing down with her finger just behind the bar. And I looked over the top there, and there is literally a Japanese soldier. I can't believe it. Jacket, putties, the boots with the little cleft thing in the toe. Absolutely blotto he is. I imagine he was something to do with the family. Maybe he was the owner of the cafe for all I know. But he was in full Japanese, very well worn and washed out Japanese uniform. And they all roared with laughter. And we all roared with laughter at this. And the other two came up and had a quick squint at him. But he was well away. He wasn't going to get out till lunchtime. And we said our goodbyes and went off. And they came to the door and waved us off and thanked us for saving Japan and all the rest of it. Went off down then. I think we must have broken up now. Because I went off then to find the place where the photographs were. And a bit of a struggle. But I eventually found this shop, which, asking people to point in the way and what have you. Because a great many Japanese at this time could speak English. Very, very many, because the American occupation had meant that they'd have to. And went into this little shop, gave them the ticket, and the lady put a little box about 12 inches square in front of me and said, help yourself. She could speak English, incidentally. And this was in most of the little shops had these little boxes, and inside there were, I couldn't begin to imagine, pornographic pictures of people doing all sorts of things, and one or two, that were not quite well dressed people. She went in the back, came back again, and I said to her, can I have this one? She said, oh, a very good choice. It was I've still got it now, actually, a very well-dressed Japanese person who she said was a star of film and what have you, and she's very good choice, very good choice. So I suppose I was let off the hook. I hadn't picked one of the dirty ones. Got the photographs, went off, re-met the lads, and now it's a bit of a kaleidoscope. I can't remember how each day went, but most of the evenings, by this time the sake was taking effect, of course, but most of the evenings we drank too much, to the point that occasionally you'd be absolutely blotto. And in fact, one night I was so blotto that I couldn't move, my limbs. I could crawl about, but I couldn't move my limbs. But I couldn't see, but I could hear. I knew everything quite clear. My brain seemed to be absolutely clear. And I know who it was. It was the Gloucester guy came up to me and said, could he have some, borrow some money because he'd run out. And we got £25, incidentally. We'd drawn £25, which was £5 a day, which was an enormous sum in those. I'd never spent £5 in a day ever before in my life. And he said, could he have a fiver? And he looked at my little roll of money and he said, I'd better look after that for you. And I said, no, I don't think so. And I felt round and gave him his fiver and off he went. And it was just as well I did, because the next morning he came to me again for another fiver. And I said, hold on, you had it last night. He said, no, you never paid up. I said, you did, because you said you'd look after my money for me. So thankfully I didn't give it to him, because I think that he was a little bit of a rogue maybe, and I don't think I'd have ever seen my money before. But on the first day, as we've been walking around, we've met up with an American by Corporal Esney Garnett. I remember his name, it was unusual. And he had a Jeep, and he called us over and said, would you like a trip round the Tokyo? I said, yeah, have a bit of that. So he drove us around, showed us all the places that there were. We went off round to the Empress Palace, which was absolutely opposite MacArthur's headquarters. And there were white-helmeted policemen, you know, military police with all the gubbins, you know, the white lanyards and bootlaces and all the rest of it. And the Americans who were on leave from Korea were walking around and trying to provoke them and, you know, saying things to them and that, but they fortunately totally ignored it. But they didn't hang about there, they just walked by and just, well, you know, what are you doing here? But we went over the road and went into the grounds of the Royal Palace over an old bridge, which I can't remember if there was water in the bottom, but sort of a moat thing, and walked around the grounds for a little while. But there was so much to see that I don't think you could have got, well, you obviously couldn't get into the palace, but this must have been the outer grounds around the Imperial Palace. But I'm afraid in those days, history wasn't top of our agenda for looking around things. And we obviously went off and had another meal. In fact, we only ever had breakfast in Ebisu camp, which was always very, very good. I think the last day we might have had a midday meal or something. And life was wonderful. It was really first class. We had a very good time. But I never really got to grips with this MacArthur will pay bit. Although even on my own once I tried it and it worked. So we never paid any fares whatsoever.
How did the Japanese react when you said that? Scowlingly or happily?
No, bowed their heads. Just dropped their heads and moved on. Next one, bowed their head, moved on. They never, apparently Americans did this all the time. I'm astounded, really, that we ever got away with it, but it never caused a problem. And but now our Esty Garnett, he's picking us up each day in a Jeep and taking us around to various places, took us home to his flat where his Japanese wife was. I mean, I don't think these were wives in the sense that we would think it. They were girlfriends who each soldier had and passed on, sort of thing, because you had to take your boots and what have you off to walk in. So we sat on the step. We wouldn't go in, which he wanted us to. And we could see, you know, they were waving from the back. And there was an Australian sergeant there giving us the old, you know, I know what you're up to a bit, but he was wrong. And we left, went off, he took us around. In fact, one night he was so late getting back that he said he had to get the I think it was, I can't remember, it was 2300 or 2400, whatever time he had to get the Jeep back by, because they borrowed him from the motor pool. And he said to me, the other two lads went off, and would I come back with him and explain that, you know, sort of more or less take the blame for keeping him out late. So we went back, and I think I was a bit, I was fairly well under the influence. I suspect he was as well, probably, because he was with us all the time. We got it back into the motor pool, and there was just a desk, and he just had to go up and explain, and they were giving him a bit of a rocket. There were WACs and soldiers there all lined up. And I'm trying to defend him and say it's all complete.